Great. Thank you. All right. Welcome back to the Ors Harua Talmud class. Good to be back in the Beit Midrash with everyone, and really lovely to get started again after all the holidays, to get started into a new Masechta this year, a new tractate of Talmud. Ta'anit is an incredibly rich 30 pages long. It's wonderful. We're going to, God willing, get through the Masechet this year, 31 pages long, and see that it's filled with reflections on our relationship with, first of all, first and foremost, God. All about God's might. All about God's powers in the world. There are some powers that are going to be compared, contrasted, bundled in the same package, and we're going to ask ourselves, as we see those right from the start, wow, that's a pretty interesting package display. That's a pretty interesting package display of God's powers. I see.
Thank you.
And so it's going to be a wonderful learning that way, philosophically, and by way of ritual, as I mentioned in the write-up. Some of the earliest liturgies we have, some of the earliest prayer experience in community we think we have, is the experience of hoping, praying for rain. And that has biblical origins in terms of the commandment to pray. Whereas, I'll even put it this way, you could have a debate about where the actual commandment to pray comes from. And in fact, Rambam and Ramban have those arguments. So the notion of the experience of prayer from the ancient world that's connected to the very natural, that's very obvious why, right? Natural world, our ancestors believed very much and know very much that God is in complete control of that, but our behaviors, our sins, our relationship with God, our relationship potentially with more than that, makes for a difference in how the world and when the world is blessed with rain. And I think that that notion of the relationship, again, vertically and horizontally, vertically and horizontally, really comes out in a really interesting way in this tractate. Because we're people, if you will, of this world, and we're people in that spiritual relationship, and in the Talmud we're going to have explorations of that, thinking about the way that rain really does create the flourishing realities of the world, and you can see the growth of the plants and the tevuah, the yield, the crop. You can see that happen. You'll have an exploration in this Masechta of Jewish history, of world history. Right? Because when we think about noting how the season unfolds and whether or not we're going to have the right yield in the right time, there's the punishment sin theology that's going to come into play again. You know, were we blessed at this moment with the right produce? Were we blessed to continue a long living the way we want to live at this season, in this time, this year, vis-a-vis the relationship we have with God and what God might do in terms of the punishments, in terms of withholding blessing, which rain is going to be a symbol for. But then we're going to get within this conversation about the natural world and what we're to do to impact the natural world and how the natural world impacts us, the conversations about history that are connected to some of the ritual practices that we use to hope for rain. And that is the fasts that come into play are, of course, fasts that come for rain, and they're also fasts that link very deeply to the world of Jewish history and the historical events. And so the fasts that we make in order to get God's blessing of rain are, in a sense, that sense, parallel to the fasts we make in hopes that God is going to bless us as the garden to be cared for, you know, in that metaphor of produce and the rain comes on us, the Gishmei Bracha will have the blessings, the blessed rains, in terms of our longevity on earth and the flowering and the yield of the Jewish people, if you will. So that's, by way of introduction, really where we're headed. And there's going to be some specifics at the beginnings of the practices that we use in liturgy. And by way of that more specific introduction, I'll get into it in a moment. Before we actually now jump in further into texts and some study together, we have such a wonderful group assembled around the table that I just thought we should share names for a moment, because I'm not sure that everybody knows one another yet, and I thought, you know, good to say your name to one another. And what we like to do here is we like to have an open kind of questioning and dialogical experience with the Gemara itself, but I those who are, you know, fellow travelers, which most of us are, know how that goes. And sometimes we're rolling through a text and I'll say, hey, let me just finish through the text because the text is going to answer that, and it's in no way trying to avoid the question, or well, maybe sometimes. No, it's a way of sometimes the text needs to keep going on the tracks before we get to the questions. Keep your question in mind. Put it in the parking lot, if you will. So if I can just ask you to go around this way.
I'm Bobby Kohler, and I've been coming to the Talmud for a long time, and happy that we're starting again.
And I'm Barry Kohler.
Bill Hyman.
Marion Hyman.
Arthur Sully.
Rich Eunice.
Harry Hughes.
Diane O'Krin.
Rob Schaefer.
Ron Eisenberg.
Henry Glanton, Italian Yosef, Ben, Meir, Jay.
Let's all go to bed.
Charlie. Fred Side.
Judy Sykes.
Mira Epstein.
Maurice Horowitz.
Very good. Very good. So, to continue. You have in front of you a copy of two pages from the Siddur that we use from the Sim Shalom. And the reason why I gave you the copy of the pages of the Siddur is because right from the outset of this Masechta, the rabbis of the Mishnah imagine you are totally literate with the practice of saying the Amidah as a prayer in the community of Israel. In much the same way that Mishnah Brachot opens up, the very first Mishnah of Masechet Brachot, Tractate of Blessings, the very, if you want to say that there's an order, the first tractate of the Mishnah. And Talmud, remember, is built on Mishnah, that core text 200 CE, edited by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, and we're going to have then the expansion, conversations about that Mishnah, and discursive, connected conversations that are happening on pages in between Mishnayot. We use that as an organizing principle, that in the Mishnah we have 63 tractates, and each of them, the tractates are divided into chapters, and each selection within a chapter is called a Mishnah. So you can have a Mishnah of the Mishnah. And the first Mishnah of Tractate Blessings starts, Me'ematai korin Shema ba'arvim. When do we read the Shema at night? What do you have to already know with that question? That you read the Shema, what the Shema is, how often you do it, that it has to be daily. Because if I don't have that kind of literacy, it's kind of like coming into the middle of a postmodern novel. You're in the middle of someone's story, and it's all going to have to unravel in some way that I'm going to get an explanation. Who's this? What's this? Maybe. But this Masechta, this tractate, opens in pretty much the same way. It's going to include us as participants in the conversation that's already started, because we practice this. We are people who know from getting together to pray when there is no rain. We are people who know from an Amidah that's been somehow crystallized, if not canonized, by this time. And that's early on, right? We say that the Amidah is one of those early, early texts, some of the earliest texts we have. And already the rabbis have oral traditions. And by the way, when you have oral traditions, you know, if you have a good recipe and it comes from 10 generations and it's an oral tradition about how to still cook that kind of thing, and there are recipes that are that old and that in oral culture that have been passed along that long and transmitted, we know this, right? So if there are 10 generations even since the very first times that people start creating an Amida liturgy, or maybe a few less generations. And they talk about it being created not only in Israel, but also as part of the diaspora experience when Mordechai and Esther were in the Persian Empire. All these are kind of saying that these are old and ancient texts that we've inherited as poetry, that we've inherited as liturgy, that we've inherited to use as pleas before God or praises of God. And in the Talmud that I mentioned of blessings, we know that there are praises of God, there are pleas and requests before God, and there are thanks, poetries of thanks, liturgies of those three types that are created and are used and in use by our people by the time the Mishnah is really put together. And here, the Mishnah is going to open in the same way, just stylistically, I want to preface, you know, make the precy. It's going to open in pretty much the same way. It imagines, you know, that there's an Amida, and it imagines, you know, that there are at least two places, and I say at least because there is another one, if not two. But that's for a different time. But there are two places where you have lines of liturgy that concern rain. And we're really jumping right into that issue of rain. It knows that you know, the Mishnah imagines, again, your literacy with Atagi Borle Lamaranai Mechae Metimata Ravlo Shia Birkat Givurot, God's great powers. You are the great power in the world, God. Atagi Borle Lamaranai, forever and ever. And you have it here in the middle of page 106 on the sheet in front of you. Michae Meitim Ata Rav Lohoshia, you at one point will revive the dead, or you revive the dead, it seems to be in present tense form. So is your salvific power in the world. You have saving power. And from Shmini Atzeret to Pesach, it says here in our English instruction, in our Sidur, Mashiv Haruach Umarita Gashem, you cause the wind to blow and the rain to fall. And that's a good thing. Despite my students who used to say it on our Israel trips, do we really have to say that? And the answer is yes, you really have to say that. And you're looking for the rains of blessing in the land of Israel. And by the way, that line is tied directly to the land of Israel. And the idea is that you want the wind to blow and the rain to come. Why do you need the wind to blow in addition to the rain? Yeah, because you've got an entire world of agriculture that's got to unfold. The seeds have to blow. The kind of reality of what creates that seasonal effect and impact on the insect life that's going to happen. Some of the soils are going to need to churn. Oh, the wind is doing a lot more than we imagine, in addition to rain starting, and we want the rain to come. And by the way, in the ancient world, the word rain and gashem, or geshem, and that's a little bit of a grammar point, but let's not worry about that now. People knew that to be a certain type of precipitation. There are many, many words for precipitation in the ancient world, in the Tanakh itself. They knew from the difference between tal and dew, like we know, but they also know other words, a lighter rain, a soft, they have different words in their vocabularies.
Matar.
They know very different words for the kind of rains we have. Now, we have a few of those words in English. Drizzle.
Pouring.
Like tomorrow.
They didn't have a cat and dog. They did not have cats and dogs. But they have lots of words, and so they want a serious rainfall because they know that it's linked to the health of their crops and that it is seasonal in the sense that with a good rain, the land of Israel will give its crops, and without rain, you will not have a great yield. That begins Shmini Atzeret Pesach. We have one other place that the rabbis, right from the start of the Masechta, are going to want to make sure you know, remember, and can contrast in your mind. And that is, take a look on the other side of the page. Go down to the Barech Aleinu blessing. That's the second official blessing on that side of the page. You see there it says, Lord our God, make this a blessed year. May its varied produce bring us happiness. Grant, and in the summer, we're going to say blessing to the earth. And during the winter, in our Siddur, printed for North America, this version can't be taken to Israel and used, it is going to say between December 5th and Pesach, let dew and rain come to bless the earth. Now, this was a perfect timing question, Judy, the other day. I walked into Friday night services and Judy said, what is it that we base our decision to say Mashiach Baruch, which we just looked at, on the Jewish calendar, and you have Shemini Atzeret, and you know it's a Jewish date tied to Shemini Atzeret, and we have it says December, between December 5th and Pesach. Well, so what's the story? So the easy explanation is that all of our liturgy publicly is tied to the agricultural cycle of the land of Israel. And so when you're talking about Mashiva Ruach, Morid HaGashem, you're not talking about New York City. So you really can say, can I not say this in New York? Really, you aren't saying this for New York, even though you're saying this. You're tying yourself into the whole notion of the agricultural cycle in Israel. That's first and foremost. But outside of the land of Israel, Eretz Yisrael, which is at a different latitude, then...
Or both.
The difference in positioning on the globe means that they didn't want rain the same time Eretz Yisrael wanted rain. And nor do, especially, diaspora communities that are completely far away from Eretz Yisrael, they don't want rain and wind in those seasons. And they say, let's wait. If already the rabbis could say, you could wait till Shemini Atzeret to say it, then why don't we wait a whole, what's called, tukufa? Why don't we wait a whole 60-day period? Because in Jewish mindset, the year is broken up into four different tukufot, four different periods of time. And the periods of time, for the quick review, are Tukufat Nisan. You have the spring season, when seeding time begins and when day and night are of equal length, 12 hours each. Tukufat Tammuz, the summer and harvest season begins on the longest day of the year, which is the summer solstice. Tukufat Tishrei, the fall season of ingathering begins once again when day and night are of equal duration, the autumnal equinox. And Tukufat Tevet, the winter season begins on the shortest day of the year, the winter solstice. And what does it mean? I threw in an extra fact there. Since they already waited, why can't we wait? You see, there's a debate that's going to come in the Gemara, foreshadowing. Shouldn't we say this Mashiach Baruch Morid HaGashem a little earlier? And they'll say, no, let's wait. And not only are we not going to start it right away, when we could, we're going to hold off, and it's going to be Shemini Atzeret. And then with the other blessing, Barech, even though it says December 5th and between December 5th and Pesach for the diaspora, when would it say, if I was in Eretz Yisrael, if I was in Israel? When would it say, start saying, please send dew and rain to bless the earth? Well, one might think it's Shemini Atzeret. One might think that, because I just told you that the whole picture of the liturgy is tied to the agricultural cycle of Eretz Yisrael, except that we delay it. And we delay it to the 7th of Cheshvan. You might say, why 7th of Cheshvan? I guess in the ancient world they had a few people who loved statistics. How long does it take a pilgrim leaving from Jerusalem at Shemini Atzeret to actually get back to some of the farthest points that are mapped, if I was doing a how far they come for the real pilgrimage kind of mapping exercise. By the way, fantastic presentation last night about a new atlas of Hasidic history that is first time ever, 74 different maps, and done by a researcher who spent 3 years at YIVO looking at different Hasidic communities, how their shtiblach expanded, and where from the Hasidim of that group made the pilgrimage back to the Rebbe's house, or was there never a pilgrimage back to the Rebbe's house? Was it not as Rebbe-centric as they think it is? Was it not as shtiblach as centric as they think it is? And what were the business organizations like, and how many times did they visit each other's towns for business versus making pilgrimage over to their Rebbe? Sidebar. Back to our time period. How many pilgrims actually came to Jerusalem? Where did the pilgrims actually come from? Was it from diaspora lands and they really needed a serious amount of time? How fast could you get to the northern part of Israel? How fast could you, if you were a Jerusalem-centric Jew, remember, because I've posited before that not everybody immediately bought into this notion of pilgrimage festival. The local Kohen has a little bit of business going on. Prayers versus actual temple worship are very important. Where are the synagogues? What are they doing in those synagogues that have the beautiful tile floors versus the actual temple during the time the temple is actually around? Because we know from Professor Levine that those temples and synagogues exist at the same time, right? But the back to here, the question is, how long does it take some of that pilgrims to get back home? It takes them a little while. So we wait until 7 Cheshvan. We wait till 7 Cheshvan. And so if we had an Israeli version of Sim Shalom, it would say, from Shmini Atzeret, from Ashiva Ruach, and it would say 7 Cheshvan, which has become the accepted practice. All places, even if you live in a place that has the same longitude, same latitude, but on a different longitude, as Eretz Yisrael, and you need the rain in the same season, they still wait for the next period, and the December date would be the date they go by, because we respect that the prayers are really for the notion of that connectivity to our central homeland and Israel, and we don't want to say that the prayers are about our own landscape and start it now, despite the fact that I'm on the same bandwidth, if you will, and want that rain. So that's the literacy, the white space before the Mishnah that needs to be filled in before we even start the conversation into the first Mishnah and the first Gemaras of our tractate.
Quick question.
Yep.
What's the difference between Matar and Geshem?
So Geshem is a steady rain pour. Matar is a little lighter, and even some wind can knock it around. So you know how sometimes you have that.
Showers, I think. It's harder.
And the wind can blow the cloud so that you have a shower, you have a strong shower, and it's not all the time straight down. It could be on an angle, and you know the clouds are kind of moving, and a lot of the angular rain is when the clouds don't sit right above you. So, and that's the difference over there. Tal Matar can also be straight showers. And there's no doubt that Geshem could be linked to it, just like I have sometimes, oh, it's a storm. Well, I use the word for both, right? Same way. But there is some distinction, and you could make some distinction if you really wanted to.
The 7th of Heshvan isn't always December 5th.
Correct. In other words, you have a different day, no matter what, in Eretz Yisrael, which is 7th Heshvan, that you start saying this.
Right, but I'm saying
December 5th is always, yeah, but it's the winter season of the diaspora. It became a standard kind of, the winter of the diaspora is December 5th. I see what you're...
And when did that get standardized?
It's definitely in halacha by the Middle Ages. It really is already... Yeah, well, obviously, I was just going to say that the Babylonians didn't have the same calendar, so you wouldn't say December 5th, but they waited a tekufa. In other words, they were told to wait 59 on the night, after 59 days, night of, day, new day starts, 60 days, the new tekufa, the new period starts, and that's the time that you in the diaspora need rain versus us in Israel who started on 7th Cheshvan.
It's interesting that it's not the winter solstice. It makes sense to say, on the winter solstice, now it's before.
Right, and that's because we like to organize our lives in these periods, and even though, you know, I could say 60 days times 4, it's not really a year, right? But we have these kind of periods, and we use the period from the new year after we were judged for rain as the kind of beginning of that period, and so we define it within this 60-day time frame, and in the diaspora, again, 59 days are done, start saying it. Over there in Israel, they need it. The season's really already started. We gave a little time to the pilgrims. Seven cheshvan is the day. Okay, and lastly, before we jump into the Mishnah, why is this Masechta Tani after Rosh Hashanah? Well, most people who think about the organization of the Gemara think about it in terms of the length of the tractates. When I talk about editors or the publishers designing the order of the tractates, it makes sense, though, that it comes after Rosh Hashanah, if not after Sukkot, because I've just had a Yom Kippur fast. Now, Yom Kippur was longer, and it's not anywhere near here, so I couldn't say Rosh Hashanah and then Yom Kippur. I don't really organize it by the calendar year when I come to this Seder of the Mishnah, right? There are six Seders of the Mishnah. This is Seder Moed. This is the Seder called the Seasons, meaning the holidays and seasons of the year. And I get this, though, right after Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is, again, a time when it started the season of this to become the winter season that I need the rain in order for the ground to soak in all the rains in Eretz Yisrael and then grow them properly. I also fast on Yom Kippur. I have the connection to fasting. Ta'anit comes from the same root as what we learned last year, those of us who were in the Beit Midrash. La'anot, to mortify or afflict oneself or answer to your sins, for your sins. Right? We talked about the la'anot not just being about afflict yourself, but answer for your sins, answer for the way things are happening in the world, and throw it back to God and say, we will pledge to you our loyalty, we will do mitzvah, we want the rain to come. And some of the parallels that came from that experience of fasting on Yom Kippur, the question is, which came first, right? Were they there at Yom Kippur and therefore integrated into some of the Mishnayot we're going to see down the line in this Masechta? Or were, again, public fasts about rain and about matters dealing with agriculture and history, the beginnings of some of our practices when it came to Ta'ani, when it came to fasting? And did we learn into Yom Kippur from the fasting practices of our ancestors who fasted for rain in its season to repent, to gain atonement, and then to gain the blessing of rain, so that that expiation and the being cleansed of sin was associated always with the actual blessing of the rains that we need for our yield, our produce, our production, our living here, our bountiful living within the land of Israel. And they have to work once we're excommunicated, if you will, once the temple's destroyed. The rabbis have to work in Yoma to understand that there's a deeper and larger picture of expiation to do through a fast, and therefore you get that overlay of fasting as the practice within Yom Kippur, and not just the avoda of Yom Kippur, not just the work of the temple that will expiate for all of Israel and just Aaron and his house, right? We talked about this development that really is a layer, because the actual practice of fasting for Yom Kippur was not in that part of the Torah. The fast and verb la'anot, remember where we saw that, was in Psalms. So the combination of the verb la'anot, the core of our Masechta Ta'ani, of our tractate, the core of the practice of fasting, ayin nun hey, is associated with fasting, yes, in the Tanakh, but was not associated in the Torah in the Yom Kippur section. So we're going to have a bunch of those questions come back around, if right now that's settling in as a question, because you didn't learn Yoma last year, the tractate about Yom Kippur. Hold off. That will become clearer as we see some of the practices that look very familiar vis-a-vis Yom Kippur within this tractate where we're fasting for rain. Yeah. Okay. That's all my introductory stuff, so we can get into the Mishnah now. Yeah? Let's do it. All right, for those of you who have not yet purchased your Masechet Hani, there is only one volume of it in the Art Scroll series. You can get it. I just heard Rob said that Westside Judaica has it in stock, also directly from the Art Scroll website. It's shipped directly to the house, and it's Tanis in Ashkenaz, Ashkenazic English, T-A-N-I-S. Chapter 1, 2A1. All right, it made a brief explanation in the idiomatic information here in the commentary that during the winter, two references to rain are added to the Shemona Esrei prayer. Shemona Esrei is the other name for the Amidah, right? Mashiva Ruach, Umrida Gashem, and Vitein Talumat HaLevracha, which we just discussed. The Mishnah refers to this power of sending rain as Gvurot Geshamim, the powers of rain. So just to remember that this is a power that God has. Gvurot Geshamim. This is the Mashiva Ruach Umrida Gashem in the Gvurot blessing of the Amidah. Barech Aleinu, the second time we say anything about rain, Tein Tal Umatar, that's a request. So let's classify the first one, Mashiva Ruach Umrida Gashem, celebrating God's power of making rain, Gvurot Geshamim, the power of making rain, and the second one in the Barech blessing is the request for rain, Bakashat HaGeshamim, or the notion of the pleading before God, Tachanun LaGeshamim. Tachanun is generally not used as the phrase, Bakashat LaVakesh Geshem is more the language that, say, we would learn from Talmud of blessings in the Masechet Brachot. So the mission is going to start. Mei Matai, the word really rings true to those who know what it says at the beginning of Masechet Brachot. Mei Matai, oh yes, this is a familiar ring literary-wise of how the Mishnah is organized. When, Mei Matai, Mazkirin, Gevuro Geshamim. When do we begin to mention the powers of rain? Meaning, when do I insert the line in my Amidah, Mashiv HaRuach Umarida Gashem? Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Rabbi Eliezer says the following, Miyom Tov HaRishon Shel Chag, it's the first day of the festival. Now, if I just say Chag, what might we think Chag is referring to? Well, we could have a big question, right? But here, we know it's Sukkot. Because the way the rabbis refer to Sukkot in our Mishnah and in the Gemara is HaChag. Sukkot is the Chag. Rabbi Yoshua says, Mi Yom Tov Ha'acharon Shel Chag. So Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua are having a disagreement in the Mishnah itself. You have the Tana Kama, Tana being a sage from the Mishnaic era who teaches an opinion within the Mishnah itself. Rabbi Eliezer says it's on the first day of Yontif, and Rabbi Yoshua says it's on the last day of the festival, meaning Shmini Atzeret. We're going to go with that for anyway, because really it says Yom Tova Aharon, right? Rabbi Yoshua challenges Rabbi Eliezer's position. We're still within the Mishnah. Amarlo Rabbi Yoshua. By the way, what does that sound like already? That one is in dialogue with the other. Do we get that in every Mishnah? That one sage actually starts talking to another sage? Or do we sometimes only get this one says that, this one says that. Chachamim either go with him or they have their own position. We don't always get proto-Talmudic discussion, proto-Gemara discussion. So one way to understand a Mishnah that now expands with this kind of, let's put these two or record their dialogue, It's very legitimate. You can have a Mishnah that does this. You can have a Braita that does this. But the editors of the Gemara, ultimately, or the writers of the Gemara, have some examples from which to base themselves, and these are some of the examples that exist for us within the Mishnah itself. So Rabbi Yeshua says to Rabbi Eliezer, Hoil ve'ena gishamim eila siman klala b'chag. But since rain on the festival of Sukkot is nothing but a sign of a curse, because why? It's klala. Kid amrina b'masechet Sukkah, Rashi says, b'perek hayashen, in other words, when you want to sleep out there, if it gets wet, sorry, you can't do it. Like, that's terrible. That's a terrible thing. How could you possibly say from the beginning we should start asking for rain? You just might get what you ask for. Lama humazkir, why should one mention rain on Sukkot? Amar lo Rabbi Eliezer, but Rabbi Eliezer replies and says, Af ani lo amarti lishol. Did I say, in other words, this is, did I say that we should start requesting rain? You're not listening. Very nice the way they wrote it. Even I did not say that one is to request rain. Did I say that? He asks. I didn't say one is to request rain. Meaning what? I didn't say tein talumatal racha in the Barach blessing.
It's praising.
This is the Gevurot section of the Amida. The Gevurot section of the Amida is the section where we talk about God's powers in the world. And God has a unique set of powers, and one of them is Gevurot Geshamim, is to provide rain in its time. Ela lahazkir mashiva ruach umurid hageshem ba'onato. I said mention God's rain-giving power by reciting this phrase, mashiva ruach umurid hageshem. Now can you just, now, next time you say this line, you're saying a line that was said in the Mishnah. Like, let that sink in. Incredible. To me, that's incredible. And how many generations before that said this line? That's really just something. It's really just something. And only that one is to mention that power. And Amar Lo, Rabbi Yeshua says then to Rabbi Eliezer, Im Kain, if so, that the mention of God's rain-giving powers with that phrase, he makes the rain fall, does not imply a request for immediate rain. La'olam yehei mazkir. Then why shouldn't I mention it? Meaning, all year. Why are you telling me to stop and start? If your point is that it's one of God's powers, and that lets me, in my awareness of God's presence in the world, understand God in what Heschel would say, right, is the immanent God versus the transcendent God who has powers within this world, why not say it all year? Why start and stop? Now, liturgy standpoint and spiritual practice standpoint, why might someone want to insert a prayer at a certain time and change it up a little bit and then say a different nusach?
Introduce the idea and then...
We could probably, if we continue to expand, really write a beautiful poetic reason for that beyond your headline, right? There's real reason why I might create poetry that has moving parts, even about the powers of God. Right? We know nuschaot from the ancient landscape. We know versions of prayers for winter months and summer months of the Barech prayer. Full different liturgy. We found in the Cairo Geniza. So there is a possibility that one could sit next to the other. As a matter of fact, we still have that. When do we say one version of Shalom and when do we say another version of Shalom? Right? At night we say Shalom Rav. Right? And in the morning we say Sim Shalom. So we know from saying things differently But he is asking the question. Based on your logic and based on your argument, I might think that then we should say it all year. The requests you told me you're making in Varech, you can wait for. But you're not going to say about the power that is life-giving, life-sustaining in the ancient world that God actually has Gvura Gishamim? Rabbi Yeshua's argument is that, you know, it's that to the nature of the world. Mishnah rules like this. Ein sholim zagishamim, eila samuch l'gishamim. We don't request rain except close to the rainy season. And we don't begin to mention the powers of rain until the last day of the festival of Shemini Atzeret, which immediately precedes the rainy season. By the way, does the Mishnah really rule on our question with this response? No. The Art Scroll idiomatic translation sets it up with the word rules. This is where our careful reading of the editors of Schottenstein edition has to come into play. Right. What does the Steinfeld's edition says? Now, this is the one volume of the Steinfeld's edition. It says, sometimes we go here to compare the translation. So Rabbi Yeshua says to him, if so, if reciting the phrase does not constitute a request for rain, one should always mention rain, even in the summer. And then, Ein sholin et ha-gishamim el ha-smuch l'gishamim. What does it say? The Mishnah states a general principle. One requests rain only immediately preceding the rainy season, as if, now we're talking about a principled approach to what? The request. But had we really resolved the discussion about the powers? Not really. Not really. And so I don't know that the word rules is a good insertion over here by the Schottenstein definition. Anyway, so you have this principle. You only request the rain, sholin, and that's the other term. Like I said, bakasha, because I was using the language of tractate blessings, Masechet Brachot. Here, this Mishnah will introduce sholin, lishol. So what is lishol? It could mean ask, as in a question, but here it's ask for. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I know you, so I'm pointing out that you use the right, preposition there. That we need to understand it as in, you're really requesting, in with real strength. When you lishol something, also in ancient terminology, and even in today, I think, it's borrow. And then you become someone absolutely responsible for what you borrow. So there's force here of a different type than just ask a question.
I had a question. If they knew at that time the raining season, why didn't they need to ask for rain? It will come anyway.
Because what they're willing to sense in their life is that natural law, though you can identify it, and later on the Rambam will call it Olam Kaminago Noheg, the world marches according to its orders, right? They're willing each time to associate a lack of rain, B, a drought, C, famine, those types of events, to the interplay. They ascribe that to the interplay of God with our world and us with God. You may have the most logical deductions or beginnings of scientific inquiry happening in world history, and for a long, long time, those are evidence of what you can generally put your faith in because God wound the world up like this. And instead of God only being a watchmaker who then wound it up and let it go entirely, you could say, hey God, how about moving a chess piece? You could say, I want you to be involved here. And by really having that deep sense of faith, even if I know this is the general season, and I can discern patterns within nature, I'm going to have this relationship with the living God of both history and nature.
And also, it does vary. Bad seasons and good seasons, if you're a farmer, which all these people were.
so you certainly want a good season, so you want the right rains at the right time, at the right amount, not too much, not too little. And also, this first blessing after the Shema.
Yeah, I mean, that's everything.
Where it's
that.
Laid out. If you forget all this stuff that we're teaching you today, they're going to with you, you know, you're not going to get the rain.
No doubt.
So that was my question as well from the Shema. Is the Shema before all of this, that prayer connected to the Shema already by this time?
So nice that you asked. I'll pay you later. We'll take the break. We'll take the break and we'll do this piece. This question is the natural question that comes up. These are the questions. And the answer about was it there before? The answer is yes, it was there before. The answer is that if you want to come at it from Bible studies, ancient societies kind of standpoint, studies standpoint, boy, we're going to talk about rain gods, relationship to rain spirits, relationship to rain rituals, rain dances, talk about it around the globe as part of spiritual systems. The difference by us is that God's oneness is also inherently tied into this. So that cosmic power of God's oneness is the force that manages nature versus any one given God or another. And that the universal God can control this for all peoples, and that there doesn't need to be a panoply of deities that we pay homage to. And if you want to talk about punishment and sin theology that is more pronounced about individual sins and how God then treats what license you're granted to be a successful soul in the world or an actor in family or community or what have you, one of the earliest linkages between one's own behavior and the gain of blessing in life comes through the Deuteronomy text that you mentioned and how that works. In ancient Israel, we will see, as I mentioned, this notion of prayer and when one begins to start praying for this and asks for it or just mentions the power. That's mentioned in a biblical source that I put on the bottom of this source sheet. So let's look quickly at some of Deuteronomy chapter 11, which you're talking about. And then let's look at a source from Kings, from the book of Malachim, that will deal with this question of where from we get this notion of asking, despite whatever we know, from royal journals about how much rain fell or how much didn't, or whether it comes in the same date or not, with the same astrological symbols in the sky or not. You know, people kept records of this kind. So let me pass these around. Take one, Pat. So let me just say that the assumed literacy that we started with in my praise in the Hakdama here, the preface, this too is part of that literacy. This too is part of what the rabbis know you know. Know we know when it comes to really thinking about this. So Deuteronomy chapter 11 says, for the land whither thou goest in to possess it is not as the land of Egypt from whence you came out, where thou didst sow thy seed, didst water it with thy foot as a garden of herbs. In other words, it's going to be different by way of the water policies and the experience with water for your crops. And rain is going to be really essential for you, so understand how essential it is. But the land, when you go to get it, is a land of hills and valleys, and it drinks water as the rain of heaven comes down. Limitar hashamayim tishte mayim. Wow. The land drinks the water. It needs to drink the water. And that's why...
It's not the Nile Delta.
It's not the Nile Delta.
A land which God cares for, the eyes of God are always upon it, because God's eyes, please, God, keep your eyes on it. You need to have your eyes on it, because we need this water from the beginning of the year until the end of the year. And it shall come to pass, if you hearken diligently unto the commandments which I command you this day, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, and you, for your part, you've got to do commandments. Why? Because then I'll give you the rain of the land in its season. I then will grant you that matar artzechem, the precipitation of your land in its time. Your reyum al kosh, that you may gather in your corn and wine, vasafta ziganecha, and your grain, v'tiroshcha v'yitzarecha. And those are, by the way, vasafta ziganecha v'tiroshcha v'yitzarecha, if you recall, on Shavuot, for those of us who had the chance to pray together, I gave a talk about those three staples of the ancient world, the grains, the early wine, Tirosh maybe is not so early, but it's generally seen as early, and Yitzhar, and the oil, as being very important by way of festivals and holidays. And those three, we most likely had festivals early on for each of those three when they would mature and we could celebrate their production, their gathering and production. So that the grain one we've kept with the Omer and the barley, right? But the question is, during the summer, why don't we have any for the early grapes for the Tirosh, and why don't we have any for the oil, for the olive oil that would have been produced? And the answer is, they probably fell by the wayside after we truly celebrated the staple of our diet, the staple of our animals' diets, with the barley offering at Shavuot. And then the whole harvest gets a celebration with Sukkot. And of course, where does wine get celebrated within our culture? It's a companion libation offering in many cases, with other offerings that we give in the temple, so that we do recognize that. And also, where does oil play a part in the mincha offering, at least some of them, right? So we do incorporate these very important ancient kinds of products from the ancient world of agriculture within our system. We just don't have particular festivals for them. But all of it is dependent upon your keeping the commandments and getting the rain in its season, and I'll give grass in the fields for the cattle, and you shall eat and be satisfied, and that's the only way you're going to have enough food. Take heed to yourselves, lest you be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods. In other words, I am the single God. You do not need to have a rain god. You're going to be derailed by that. Don't get derailed by that. That's not the way the system works for ancient Israelites, for the world, and the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you. Okay, so it's all connected to our commandment doing, and it's connected to the understanding that it's not other gods who provide this, it's our God.
When they say the former rain and the latter rain, does that mean the early crops and the late crops? What does that refer to?
That means, right. That,
no, I think it's the first and the last rain.
Yeah, it means the beginning of the season,
the end of the season.
Yeah,
I've always been fascinated with this, because in some ways it says that people can take away God's free will, meaning that if they do behave, he's got to give the rain. So it's, people have the power to actually compel God's action. And I think the other piece of this is the word ye is communal, not individual.
That's for sure.
So I think that that's another interesting thing about, this is not individual responsibility, this is communal responsibility. So you've got to round up every last one to be sure they're on board. But if they're all lined up, this is pretty explicit about what God will do. And so I think that notion of people having the ability to compel God's action is a bit of a paradox, needless to say, but a fascinating one, that's always fascinating.
I think you're on to outlining your next or wrote article.
Okay.
Because I think in every period of Jewish history, and we could talk about this further, but just as an immediate response and a thought, in every period of Jewish history, you could find sometimes the same terms being used and sometimes new terminology being used for conceiving of the ability of the Jewish people, particularly, sometimes all people, to move God into fulfilling God's promises. on a covenantal level with us, and for all creatures, the satisfaction at least of food and grain, and that hunger is so central to it, the project. In the biblical sense, the notion that some of my sacrifices move God, so from the sacrificial system I can see that, to the larger legal system of Deuteronomy that we're reading now, that I can really move God. My being able to throw tshuva in God's face, but did not I repent? And didn't you promise? V'salachta, beginning with Moses' conversation about tshuva, and then the Rambam's philosophical discourse about moving God to a place of mercy and the liturgy of the Maaser versus the place of deep judgment. Fast forward so that I won't go into each time period now, to the Hasidic world where it's based in the mystical texts of the Middle Ages, where you have hit orruta de la ela, you have an awakening on high of the Godhead in the mystical system, or God, and that God is called to answer to what is happening down to the point where my body and the way I use my body, in a Pirkei Avot sense, make your will his will, and make his will your will, which is a Mishnah in Avot, is taken to such a degree that we really have this chutzpah belief that we move God. It would be a fascinating study to see it through the layers of Jewish history. Okay, so we're going to move God to provide the rain. How are we going to move God to provide rain? Look at the Malachim text now. Look at the Kings down below. Kings 1, verse Malachim Aleph. I'm in chapter 8, verses 35 to 36. It's when you're not going to have rain, ki yechet ulach, because they've sinned against you, v'hit palalu, and there's the verb where mit palel is prayer. That's the verb we use for prayer today, mit palel. El hamakom, you're going to pray to God, hazeh, that, you know, our God, that God, v'hodu et shemecha, and you're going to thank God's name. Those of you who see Sidur class know, when it says you pray to God and it says pray to God's name, I think this is the shiluv, this is the coming together of the ancient clans, one group who really found God in God's names, Adonai, Eloheinu, all those folks, and the worship of those names as the gateway into God's presence versus the meditation on some kind of transcendent God with no form, body, not even letters, not even names. Umechatatam yeshuvun, and here's tshuva. They're going to do tshuva, they're going to pray to your name, ki ta'anem, when you afflict them. Now, that verb, la'anot here, is total affliction. What's the affliction? That you have no rain, right? Again, the same root, we turn it on its head. So we will afflict ourselves, we'll self-mortify, as the religious term goes, and we will fast. Va'ata tishma ha-shamayim, you are going to hear in heaven, v'salachta l'chatar avadecha, you're going to forgive the sin of your servant, v'amcha Yisrael, all the people, Israel, ki torem et hadzerech hatova, because they will walk in a good way, asher yelechu va, that they'll walk in, v'natata matar al artzecha, and you'll give people precipitation in their land, asher natata l'amcha l'nachala, that you give for an inheritance. So, the notion that we pray for rain and that we make tshuva to get the rain in its time is here explicitly. And because that verb exists, ta'anem, you will what? You will afflict them. You will, now we expansively translate it, you will cause them to fast. So that's where from it comes. And we're moving God through those prayers, tshuva, and fasting.
So, according to the first sentence, it's only when we are not going according to God's request, we will not have the rain.
Yeah, exactly.
So, if we are doing everything according to God, and there is no rain, what's the problem?
No, but if we're doing everything according to God that we think is according to God, and there's no rain, obviously you're not doing everything according to God.
So that's always like that.
Has to be.
Okay. That's a fantastic.
because how am I going to know for real?
No, because the Aser Shamayim lo
yachid. I הבנתי מה שאתה עכשיו.
The way the sentence is.
You set it up. You teed it up for me.
Right. But the way the sentence is built up here is only if once the skies are stopped, they are going to pray. So they didn't pray before. So that's to teach them that they need to pray all the time.
Maybe.
So you see, the sentence is a little bit different.
That is, there's a fundamental question about prayer within our tractate. And it's good that they all come out, right? They all come out. As soon as you start learning it, you're a couple of lines in. Is this the root of prayer? Is having a lack of something the root of prayer? Louis Jacobs, fantastic, Rabbi Louis Jacobs, a brilliant British source of textuality, thought, Jewish thought, rabbinic text reader, chief rabbi of Britain, wrote a small booklet. And he said in that booklet that Jews will stop praying basically when they feel no more lack, that they lack nothing in their lives. And that the only time they'll come back to the well is when they need something for real. Now that need could be expressed in, I need some type of, you know, you want to have a party so you rent those crazy lights, right? I need something here, so prayer is going to be the thing. The ceremony with the prayers is going to be the way I enhance this. Because I lack something. But in a world where I feel so little lack, so little deficit, I want for very little. There will be a fall off, a further fall off of prayer, and he felt like we were at that place where we were falling off that cliff. Does then the failure of that system and what it lacks after we put our trust in, let's say, all kinds of what we were just talking, right? Geopolitical systems that seem to make sense in our era that are supposed to create the good life. Science and what we can assume through the nature and the details and the labels. But where you lack faith and where you lack an ability to pray and then come to a place where you can be happy with your portion if you do lack something. Or if you don't and you know that it could be better for others. Or if you know that there needs to be fixes and all sorts of places of strength need to be, then can we attach ourselves to prayer? Did rain and the lack of rain teach us to pray because just as the land didn't have enough rain and we didn't get enough food and we had to deal with the drought and famine, so too do we use that literally sometimes for its own sake, but metaphorically for all that it can hold, all that metaphor can be used for. And if these are the moments of the first public prayer, and we go back and say, yeah, prayer has to come from such an identification of what is lacking, maybe even in our largesse, or the largesse we feel, or the blessing we feel, or the living with the kind of comfort we live with, we could still identify what lacks and therefore pray. Because without it, would we want to pray? Right? These questions are at the core of the larger narrative sweep that we're going to see go through this Masechta.
But Deuteronomy doesn't use the word prayer at all.
Correct.
This is about behavior.
Correct.
Not prayer. And I think that's really fundamental.
It is, as I mentioned at the outset, a fantastic kind of diuk on the question of our prayer lives. Did prayer, as we know it, really come through this channel of praying for rain in its time, vis-a-vis the way that the king's text defines our activity with Lehi Palel? Or, there's a debate, right? The Rambam says that the avodah, that our prayer of the heart, the rabbis call prayer avodah shebalev, the prayer of the heart, is parallel to the Avodah of the Beit HaMikdash. Let's go back for a second to this whole conception, right? That since we had a sacrifice and since we had daily offerings, then that Gemara in blessings, in Brachot, that says it's all linked to the sacrifices of the day is right. We pray because they used to have a system in the temple to have expiation, gratitude, offer peace in the community, offer peace in the world to the 70 nations on Sukkot. That's why we pray, and prayer then is part of the mitzvah system that Deuteronomy is talking about, inherently. Okay? The work of the Beit HaMikdash, the work of the temple, the work of the Mishkan, when it stood as much a part as prayer is. Ramban will say that the mitzvah of prayer, and this is where, again, it gets back to the nature of our conversation. Ramban says the chiyuv of prayer, the obligation of prayer, ze lo kol yom. Radical notion. It's not every day. What is it? Zman ha-shmad. It's at the time of a crisis. It's at the time of a certain need. It's at the time of a deep need within community. So, let's say that is closer to the king's text and the other commandments in Deuteronomy than stay as other commandments. And the prayer mitzvah that he's learning says, in the emergency that we haven't done anything right, I'll learn from this other part of the Tanakh that they actually got together to pray, and I'll say that the mitzvah of prayer, unlike the Ramban's take that it's every day because there was work in the Beit HaMikdash, and prayer in and of itself is a different kind of avodah, worship, like the temple worship, I'll say we have to do it in time of emergency, and that links more with the whole kind of gestalt of Masechet Tani that we've now jumped into. We have an emergency, we have a crisis, we'll have historical crises, we have history, crises within history to remember, let's pray and fast and use those opportunities.
So I always felt that so a lot of prayer is praise and gratitude. And so it seems as though when you're saying
yes,
that the basic reason is for beseeching God, are we only praising and being grateful so that we butter God up before our requests? I mean,
that's again, you're asking great prayer philosophy questions that go right along with where we are. Will we ever praise God for giving rain in its season? Will we ever share our gratitude in special tefillah? Will the discussions within our masechta reflect a certain amount of praise?
The creation is all the time,
and
not
thanks,
only in times
right,
of crisis,
right,
so we should be grateful every day.
So I want to keep that as an open question, Bobby, for our learning this year. Can we identify, as we go through the pages of our tractate, places within the Gemara where we see the other parts of prayer play out? The praises and the thanks. So let's be mindful of that question as we push through. Yeah?
I guess I was thinking along Bobby's lines, and I was going to express it a little differently, saying that we talk about the different words. We have different words for rain, and we have different, the Alaskans have many different words for snow.
Right.
We don't really have a lot of different words for prayer. But there, I mean, in the Torah, where prayer that I can remember is, you know, you should be satisfied, it is the thanks.
Well, it's a blessing there. The halta v'sabata uverachta.
Yeah, blessing, which is praise. I don't know. It's kind of like gratitude, isn't it?
I don't know, Henry.
Well, see, that's why we need more words for prayer.
Uh-huh.
What is that prayer? Then.
Yeah, I think that the notion of thanks that you're talking about is found more in the narrative version at the beginning of Genesis. You can argue right away that the thanks that we see within the births that happen, let's say, for the Imahot. You know, there's some gratitude language in there, in what we see coming out in the narrative. The blessing is a little bit different, but yes, I get your point, so keep going.
Yeah, anyway, then we had Rana said, you know, we know the rainy season's coming. What do we have to pray for it? And clearly the answer is, and it's sort of Jacob's idea also, that if rain happened all the time, we wouldn't really need to. We don't pray for the sun to come up, because the sun seems to come up every day without fail, and the one day that the sun doesn't come up, that's when we'll start praying for the sun to come up, you know. But as long as it's, we can count on it rising every day, we don't do it, but we certainly pray for rain because
it doesn't come all the time.
Yeah, no, and here's the thing.
Is that kind of prayer praiseworthy, part of what we have in mind, that we should say, please let it rain?
Well, I want to get it right back into the Mishnah.
Praiseworthy as...
I want to get it right back to the Mishnah. Isn't that the discussion that they're having? Isn't that what we're sitting here, we listen to Rabbi Elias and Rabbi Yoshua have this discussion, and Rabbi Yoshua is saying, if your philosophy is that God's power of rainmaking is fundamental to God's power, as we understand, the most powerful force in the universe, God in the universe, why shouldn't we include it every day? So that's A level of response. B is, maybe I do have liturgies that developed to recognize that goodness of God's renewing creation. You know, the sun coming up every day. B'chol yom tamid, hu mechadesh. B'chol yom tamid, ma'aseh v'reishit. God every day renews the works of creation. That's a, if you would say, a direct kind of connection to those named entities and items of the Genesis story within our liturgy. The first blessing right after the Baruch Hu, first blessing before the Shema, in the morning, right? But it doesn't take on that kind of gratitude, because also I have in prayer the notion of my kavanah. What is my intentionality? Am I willing to use this poetry, activate this poetry, in the way that you're suggesting we might activate it if we had it? I think sometimes we have it, but the question is, how do we activate it? And does it actively then make me a different person? Because if part of prayer, whether it's praise, thanks, or request, is to make me someone new, to also receive blessing in return, natural and from around me, I have to really believe this is working, even if I am a science-oriented person and just notice it out there. Let's finish the Mishnah. So the Mishnah is going and it says this principle, Ein sholin to the geshamim, elo smuch l'geshamim. I'm still on 2A1. We don't request rain except close to the rainy season. So that's a fundamental principle for the Barech blessing in the Amidah. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda is now going to say, Ha'over lisnei ha'teva b'yom tov ha'acharon shel chag, the one who goes before the ark to lead the prayers on the last yom tov of the festival, and that means Shemini Atzeret, ha'acharon mazkir, the latter one. Now, acharon, you see, they do such a nice job for us. Without the brackets, we wouldn't know that acharon was referring to the Musaf service. But we say the acharon, the Musaf leader, mentions the powers of rain. Harishon eino mazkir, the guy who davened shacharit, he doesn't say it. So that's why we announce to this day, as the silent Amidah begins, we add Mashiva Ruach. In some places, they only allow the guy who comes up to make the repetition, start with it. I've seen it both ways. Harishon Eino Mazkir, the one who does the, at first, who leads the shacharit service, does not mention the power of rain. The ones who say that a person doing a silent Amidah doesn't say it, and the Acharon does, is a very way out there interpretation of this Mishnah, by the way, that says the Acharon is the one repeating the Amidah of Musaf, and the Rishon is the one who's saying it silently, but that's really not what the Mishnah says. I mean, just to be very plain about the language of the Mishnah, because we have the received traditions, and Rashi explains that and the Gemara explains that's what we're really talking about. Finally, 2A2 at the top. Rabbi Yehuda proceeds to teach at what point in the year one ceases to mention the powers of rain, because we want to have an end to this. For Yom Tov Harishon Shel Pesach, on the first Yontov of Pesach, Harishon Mazkir, the first one who leads the Shacharit service mentions the power of rain, Ha'acharon Eino Mazkir. So you have this kind of way in where you have not the Shacharit, but yes for Musaf on Shemini Atzeret. all the way through the period, and then the Shacharit leader on the Pesach says it, and but the one who says Musaf doesn't. And already, see, we've gone from Sukkot to Pesach, and we're all changing our dishes. But in one quick Mishnah, you really can get a sense of the Jewish year coming into focus, and how we're going to then have this liturgy in our lives for a certain period of time, and how the Chagim also help us define our lives and help us define our times. And it's not just you, the farmer, you, the agriculturalist, you, the one connected to your fields, thinking about the agricultural seasons. But now, my life, I can now start to base my life on what? Sukkot to Pesach. Right? I want to define my time. The rabbis have an interest in defining time and defining our experience of life using Chagim as anchor core experiences.
By then, they knew that there were other parts of the world that where it didn't only rain during the winter, right?
Right.
And had this, you know, what impact, if any, did that have on their thinking? Or it's only Eretz Israel, so it makes no difference.
Yeah. So what's very interesting is we're talking about the Babylonian Talmud, right? It seems as though, and now we've talked about it in a number of different senses of the relationship. On the one hand, they love each other because it's the rabbinic community, and the Chachamim and the sages have an interest in creating a unified front when it comes to rabbinic law, and it comes to the Sabbath, and it comes to living on the Chagim, and it comes to living on the schedule, and it comes to all of the laws of Mishnah that they're including, and the minority ones are included, and the majority ones, and you have rulings. You don't have so many final rulings in Halakha we've noticed before, but we have this, right? So on the one hand, there's a world of Chachamim, there's a world of sages, and there's a world of rabbinic Judaism that's blossoming post, especially destruction of the temple, 200 with the Mishnah into the Gemara period. We've also noticed, right, that when it comes to questions of how the Babylonians relate to the sages of Israel, they can launch some very harif, very spicy criticism of their colleagues. A Beit Din over there doesn't have the same power as a Beit Din over here, and our colleagues from over there don't really know what they're talking about, and this one calls this sage supposed friend a guy who runs around looking like a chicken. I mean, there are insults. There are direct insults. We spent the summer looking at Talmudic insults, and many of them were from the Babylonian sages directed towards Israeli sages, land of Israel, ancient Palestinian sages. Third, Eretz Yisrael still inhabits a very interesting place within rabbinic literature. And what I paint onto my understanding of the world sometimes is not just that I'm talking about the actual physical land of Israel, but I'm mapping onto my experience of my world the overlay that I'm kind of living on Israel's soil, in Israel's space, in the space in which I live. Let's keep that question open as well. Are they mapping their diaspora experience given I'm really living on Israeli soil? You know, one of the beautiful languages of the prayer experience that I've thought about recently is this notion, and different people are attributed to having said it, but Ralph Cook for sure said it, is that prayer and prayer time and space and experience and synagogue floors and that and the like were always the Eretz Yisrael of the Jewish people in the diaspora. Right, so that I could feel as though, or I put the overlay of being in Zion in my experience as a person living in wherever I live in the world through my prayer engagement. Here, the question for the Masechta will be, seems to be talking about Israel and Israel's cycle of rain and Israel the land. Can we apply this otherwise? Can we sense that they're talking about a diaspora experience even when we're talking about the land of Israel? All right, we're going to do the first couple of lines of the Gemara to whet our appetite for the sugya that we're going to get into the next time we meet. I just wanted to tell you, though, before we end with some text, it's completely inspiring to have the tables full. And to, you know, if you have questions during the week that would clarify something for you so that you feel like you want to come back a little bit more, bringing whatever we learned, feel free, email, give me a call. Thirdly, really highly recommend the Art Scroll version, despite my, picking out a term here or there. It's such a project. It's an incredible project. Science also is nice. It also has wonderful notes. Both are out there. And you see, I'm working with both. But the reason why I suggested the Art Scroll is because it's got some very deep footnotes. Sometimes we'll go into them, sometimes not. And I hope that you feel as excited as I did to be back in the Beit Midrash. Really is wonderful. All right, so 2a2. The Gemara asks, Tana Hechakai. Dikatani Me'ematai. Much like, again, this notion of the Talmud of Blessings. What is the Tana really referring to when he asks the question, from when? I seem to be middle of the conversation here. From when what, from when do we begin to mention the powers of it? Tana hatam kai dekatani. The Tana refers to that Mishnah which states, Mazkirin gvuro geshamim b'techiyat ha-meti. We mention the powers of rain in the blessing of the resurrection of the dead. And this is why I say, it's just to whet the appetite. Wait a minute. Right? Wait a minute. Of course we're talking about mentioning the powers of rain when we talk about the powers of resurrecting the dead. That's it. That's the brayta. That's the Talmudic text that's out there. V'sho'alim b'birkat ha'shanim, and we request rain in the blessing of the years. V'havdalah b'chonen ha'da'at, and we recite Havdalah in the blessing of the gracious bestower of wisdom blessing. We're talking about now blessings of the Amida and where we insert things. So we have this practice of inserting different prayers in the right places, and we're making the philosophical connections between what it is we add and where they belong. So when do we begin the mention of the powers of rain is the question. So I just still leave it as a whet your appetite kind of thing. We'll end here. You figure out a little bit, think about this as we move into next week's installment. What's the connection between, is there a philosophical, a deeper philosophical connection between the powers of rain and Techiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead?
Remember, we used to talk about the dry bones, so the dry bones got to get wet.
Oh, there you go. Very, you're already on to it. You're already on to it.
Thank you.
Sharko Chachem. Nice touch agenda.
Thank you.
Good to see you. If you want to keep the pages, of course, you're welcome to, and if not, I'll collect them in 5 seconds.